confronted with a mysterious and difficult problem, and he finds the solution, he may cry out, "I see the answer. I see it all now." But he is not speaking of anything that he visibly sees with his eyes. He means that he sees with his mind that some kind of light has been shed upon the inward part of himself by which things previously invisible have become visible or tangible to him, like an idea that suddenly bursts upon him with a kind of internal rational luminosity. The light of the mind is the light by which things are seen through the reflecting power of the mental instrument. The light of the mind, therefore, must involve the passing of the truth through an instrument which has in the center and seat of itself the principle of ego. Thus, truth seen by the mind is truth censored by the ego. The immediate instinctive reaction is by the ego. What does this mean to me? How can I use it? How can I understand it? How can I apply it? How can I find some method by which my own destiny is advanced? Always everything is in the terms of I-ness or self-centeredness. The mind cannot, therefore, of its own nature and substance, actually experience the nature of truth or the nature of the light of Buddha. By its own very substance, the mind is the final barrier to the true experience. Because one of the things that Buddha knows or Buddha reveals is the fallacy of the self trying to know. Buddhi, corresponding as it does to the light of the Logos, represents the spiritual faculty of universal apperception possessed by the solar deity. This faculty was described anciently as azonic. In other words, this faculty was the faculty to know, to apperceive, to experience with total factuality in any place, at any time, and at all time. It has no time sequences, nor barriers, nor is it absent somewhere because it is present elsewhere. It is all-knowing, all-present, all-awareness. The light carries particularly the implication of awareness. For light cast upon a thing reveals it. Buddhi cast upon a thing reveals it. Reveals not its form or its appearance, but its absolute nature, its total being, its complete reality. To achieve this concept, to achieve this condition, therefore, man, according to the ancient philosophies, must change his polarity. Because he must move from the polarity of the earth to the polarity of the sun. And in so doing, he moves from a position of existence in time to a condition beyond time. He moves from one of the beings to the substance which sustains beings. He therefore moves from self-awareness to not self-participation in absolute awareness. As we have said, the terms are hopelessly inadequate. There is no way by which we can fully experience or describe through words that which is by its own nature and substance, obviously and inevitably beyond words. So what we have is a series of symbolical allusions, or accounts, stories, usually reserved to us in the sacred writings of the world. The stories which in themselves seem fabulous and incredible, and might be so if literally taken, but if understood for their inner content, they attempt to portray to us that which we cannot immediately understand. Budi in the old Kabbalistic mysteries was called the Merkava, or the chariot of righteousness. It is the mysterious chariot described in the vision of Ezekiel that is filled with eyes and of wheels, and in the midst of which rides the mysterious white-robed figure of the Logos. In Muslim mysticism, the Merkava is the prayer rug, the mat upon which the mystic leans and kneels, and which is the symbol of the temple. In the ancient Jewish rituals, according to the Great Assembly, the Temple of Solomon was the Merkava, or the miniature of the temple in heaven, the temple of righteousness. And in all of these analogies, we have some references or intimations of the nature of this mysterious power, the great Budi illuminating agent, which is also referred to in the old writings as the Archangel Michael, the secret God of Israel. This mysterious luminous power which overthrows the hosts of darkness, this psychopompous of the army of the Lord, who cast down Satan and his legions for self-pride, represents the struggle between universal soul and mind. The struggle of mind to usurp the power of soul. Not now human soul or mortal soul, but the world soul, the mysterious soul of God, which is the light of Budi. This soul, of course, is also the grace, the mysterious medicine of the wise. It is the emblem of the healing of all things, for that which achieves to it neither hungers nor thirsts, and the God of it neither slumbers nor sleeps. It is thus pure light as pure truth, and it fills all space, and it is the end of the quest, the mysterious search of man for the state of substantial spiritual reality. To achieve to Budi, then, is to achieve to this state of transcendent union with the pure principle of universal light. Now, when this principle is experienced, even as the fringe of its vestment passes across the soul of man, the passing, even, experience of this, therefore, is entirely different and almost completely reverse of the experience of mind. Truth is not known by cognition, as we know this term. It is not something which is accepted by the reason, nor is it the object directly of the adoration of the heart. The knowledge of it, the apperception of it, the capacity to experience it, involve faculties that man does not at the present time know that he possesses, although under certain and exceptional circumstances he may have flashes or momentary participations in the fringe of this state of existence. If man, then, is in the presence of an instrument of cognition by which the pure substance of essential light, not light as color, not light as visible luminosity, but light as the complete revelation of the substance of things. To achieve this, what is man's appropriate faculty? How can man do this? According to the Hindus, it is necessary to study a little bit of cosmogony in order to understand this point more clearly. Man's mental existence, the monastic principle with which he functions, is something which was not essentially, originally, part of his own nature. Had man been mind-born truly, and could he ascend by substance and essence no more than mind, he could never escape, for man could never create an existence superior to his own totality. But according to all the great religions, man was not born of manas. Man was a spirit, a divine being, created in the substance of the first Logos, and thereby composed of an eternal substance. Thus man possesses, in potency, and even today we recognize vestiges of it, the capacity for a spiritual existence. He has bartered this birthright for a bowl of pottage, but at the same time he could not lose that which the gods had given. Thus man by nature is destined and foreordained to pass into the state of Buddhi and to return to the mysterious land from which he came, the eternal substance of space. Therefore it is not that he must fashion some mysterious agent, that he must create some mechanical horse like the one in the story of the Arabian Nights, which carried the magician, but which was dissolved and disintegrated by the power of the adept. This building of the mechanical horse that will fly in the sky is not the answer to the mystery of Buddhi, any more than the creation of greater flying machines and things of that nature can actually mean the conquest of space. Space cannot be conquered except inside of man. He will go on and on until devices fail him ultimately, but he will still not come to the extremity of space. But he can reach that extremity within himself in an amazing and mysterious manner. So the problem of Buddhi is just simply based upon one great concept. Buddhi is always there. The light of truth never fails in this world. It is everywhere in everything. And it is the manasic principle of mind that stands as a wall or as a block. It is opinion or sense that blocks the way of illumination. There is no darkness in the world except the darkness which is in man himself. Therefore, the relief of this situation does not actually mean that man must build a Buddhic body, because that body is the temple, and it belongs to the gods. And it is said of the Ancient of Ancients, "My tabernacle is in the sun." The sun itself is the great house, the great shrine, and the great tabernacle, and the eternal temple. And man, above the principle of mind, is a worshiper in this house and has no other body required. So when the time comes, as in the story of the Bodhisattva, or the soul on the threshold of illumination, it is not that man builds a body, because he cannot create an instrument that can limit, bind, or inhibit the universal motion of light. He can never say, "My light" or "Your light." He can never fashion a house for himself out of that which by its own nature is universal and indivisible. He can never subdivide the sphere of light and create a little homestead here and there for himself. He can do these things in the world of matter up to the level of mind, but he cannot on the Buddhic level. Then the answer is the same as it has always been, and the Eastern mystic has long traversed the path of union. And that is that the only way in which Buddhi can be known is by the gradual reduction of that which is not Buddhi. As the darkness is taken from the window pane, the light shines through. You add nothing. You take away that which is not so. And that which remains when all error is removed is truth. It neither requires defense nor support. It cannot conquer, nor can it be conquered. And man cannot wrestle with it as Jacob wrestled with the angel. The actual problem is always the same. Namely, that man achieves Buddhi by the elimination of the vortex or focus of self-awareness. Because that which is universal cannot function through that which is not universal. It may be present, and it may, through certain of its attributes and forces, enlighten and vitalize the lower vehicles of man, and Buddhi does. But it can never blaze forth in its sovereign splendor until man himself removes the obstacle. And the obstacle from the beginning of time, the stumbling block unto the flesh, is selfhood, man's sense of his own identity. As long as he is himself, he hopes he will be nothing less, but he has not learned that he can be nothing more, and that is his limitation. In sacrificing that which is less, he has set a standard, his own selfhood, and in keeping that standard, he is forced to die defending it. Buddhi increases or becomes knowable or cognizable to the human being to the degree that that which is less than Buddhi no longer dominates the compound. While the individual says, mine or thine, that which is superior to mine or thine has no possibility of manifestation. And Buddhi is superior. While the individual says, I live and I die, eternity has no opportunity of expressing itself. While the individual says, this is good and this is bad, reality cannot be manifested. Thus, all these qualifications which arise in mind are through philosophy, which is the final tincturing of the mind with its own total capacity, these are gradually resolved. It is said that the wise man does not fear death, nor poverty, nor shame, because as long as he is true to himself, he can live with a good hope. It is therefore a step in this direction. But the most difficult step of all is for the wise man to get over his own wisdom. This is the impossible step, unless in the very accumulation of wisdom, the truly wise man has realized both its advantages and its limitations, and is able, therefore, to use its advantages and also, when the moment arises, transcend its limitations. Self-attachment, like the addiction to any belief, leaves the individual deprived of other beliefs and other attachments. The moment we possess, we lose participation in the universal. The moment we hate one, we lose the sense of universal love. Thus, every universal thing is destroyed by particular things. And every universal thing is revealed as man gradually releases himself from the dogmatism of particulars. Buddhi then remains as a great sea or a mysterious, unlimited ocean of light into which man casts himself by the voluntary extinction of his own personality, of his own personal requirements and desires. The old neophyte entering the temple was asked what he sought, and his answer was light. This light is Buddhi. This is the light of the world. This is the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. This is the Logos, the Redeemer. And none shall enter or approach the Father, Atma, except through the Son, which is Buddhi. This is therefore the universal Christ, which if it be lifted up, shall draw all things unto it. This concept, therefore, leads inevitably and naturally to man's only possible approach to the mystery, which is not loaded and burdened with his own arrogance. Anyone who would seek to enter the sheepfold except by the proper door, the same as a thief and a robber. And the sheepfold, which represents the sphere of Buddha, or the sphere of the redeemed, must be entered only by the proper door. And it is the same door that stands at the end of Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. It is the door of the peculiar and mysterious ultimate sacrifice of man, the relinquishing of the principle of intellectual selfhood. The mind must die like Moses on the hill of Moab, for it cannot enter into the promised land. So wisdom dies, but the great sage, like Socrates, voluntarily chose death before dishonor. And in complete wisdom, man chooses the death of the mind in order that he may fulfill the will of the spirit. And this is, of course, a kind of crucifixion upon the brow of a hill. And this is where, in the great involutionary cycle, the universal light died for man. And in the great evolutionary cycle, man redeems universal light, which is resurrected through his own renunciation. Buddha, in this way, is approached by the gradual elimination of that which is less, that which is not worthy, that which is restriction or limitation. And in the Buddhistic philosophy, the final expiation of the karma of the cycle of necessity means the absolute transcending of cause and effect through the perfect suspension of the mental principle, which, creating no more illusion, which no longer and for no further reason, sustaining or continuing the processes of division, leaves the individual with no further negative responsibilities upon his destiny. The various mystics have explained this also in the best words that they had available. In the concept of the being, the mind, going to sleep in God, of the concept of the complete renunciation of the self, that in the presence of God there is not a humbleness or a grovelingness, but a very simple and direct acceptance of destiny, the acceptance of the inevitability of the person ceasing and the border of the divine. For man is of the divine. It is his substance and his nature. And as he returns to deity, according to the Eastern life way, he does not become another god in heaven. He becomes God forever. There is but one universal principle. Evolution does not cause more of these principles. It gathers back the sparks to the flame, and the one principle continues. But that one principle, having passed through the great cycle of necessity, brings home to itself all the creatures that originally came forth from it as sparks from the anvil. In this sense, then, we can appreciate the idea that Buddha tells about and says, whence is the flame when it goes out? What happens to the fire when it goes out? Does it cease? What happens to it when it springs up elsewhere? Is it the same fire or is it a different fire? Everywhere that stone and steel meet, there is a spark. And yet every one of these sparks can go out, and the darkness and the night can extend over vast infinities of land and sky. But the flame that goes out is the mind that goes to sleep in Buddha. Now in Samadhi, the Eastern mystic approaches this, but of course if he actually attains it, he cannot return. Because once the thread between the personal and the universal is broken, once man returns to the universal, he cannot again create the illusion of separateness. Why? Because an illusion, in order to bind him, must seem real to him. He can never suffer from an illusion he does not accept. He cannot say, yes, I think I'll have an illusion this morning and we'll do accordingly. The only power that illusion has is that the person suffering from it is unable to extricate himself from it. If he was not captured by it, it could not limit him. Thus, according to Buddha, when the mind has actually achieved the reality, it can never again lose it. When the consciousness has gone on to identity with absolute truth, it is impossible for that consciousness ever again to believe in the illusion of its own individual existence. Because it cannot believe it, it cannot cause it. And because it cannot cause it, it cannot be reborn. It cannot again make the mistakes which constitute the cycle which holds it to illusion. It cannot go on being born and dying once it has experienced immortality. This, of course, is the burden in a strange but rather interesting way of O'Neill's play, Lazarus Laughed. Lazarus, having died and been raised from the dead, was free from the power of the Roman Empire, because all that Tiberius could do to frighten him was to sentence him to death. The man who had died and gone through death could not be frightened. Thus also, any state that is outgrown by consciousness can never again bind that consciousness. This is in contradistinction to our popular belief that we have relapses. Nearly everyone says, I know better than I do, and I didn't do quite so well today, but I'll do better tomorrow. This is actually not true. We all have thoughts that are better than our practices, but we do what we know. Sometimes we wish we didn't. But the fact that we energize by factual action, an illusion or a mistake, indicates that we are not master of that illusion or of that mistake. We have not transcended it, or it could not catch us even in an off moment. Thus, in the story of Buddhi, the actual experience of it automatically terminates. The possibility of relapse. Obviously, the being that attains it has passed beyond the possibility of relapse. But once this condition has been attained, a lesser condition can never capture the consciousness. Thus, the story of the Bodhisattva is, of course, typical. In the Mahayana school of Northern Buddhism, some of the Bodhisattvas, or those who are standing upon the threshold of the Great Release, pause to consider the possibility of either going on to that which is eternal, or else to come back and become ministers to the needs of their fellow men. And if the Bodhisattva makes the great renunciation and returns as the world teacher, or as a great saint, or sage, or arhat, he must do so by preserving one thread of his ancient karma. He must still have an illusion. There must be one mystery that he has not solved. There must be one renunciation that he has not made. Otherwise, he cannot come back. Therefore, the Bodhisattva is on the verge of perfection. But he keeps one ancient fault in order that he may still mingle with men and believe it. Otherwise, he cannot do so. I think, however, that the somewhat prevalent opinion that we are all voluntarily holding on to one fault for that reason is somewhat exaggerated. I didn't take it too seriously. Buddha tells us the same thing, that through the long years of his ministry, he was paying the karma, and that finally, under the sala tree, where he entered the nirvana, he committed or performed the last act of karma. He paid his last debt, and in so doing, broke the cord
bound into illusion.
For that reason, it is said that he entered the Mahaparinirvana. But only after he had given 700 lives to the teaching of his fellow men. This is the burden of the Jataka, the great stories of the birth tales of the Buddha, recounting his services to mankind through numerous embodiments. But always with the thread of imperfection left unbroken in order that he might return. Thus, man may attain to a very great degree of insight. But what is the thread that must remain unbroken? The final, ultimate, and last thread of all, the last spark of self-identity. Only because he is a self-identified being can the Bodhisattva resolve to come back. Only because he preserves the thread of self-determinism can he teach. Can he say, I am a teacher? Or can he presume or assume to serve his fellow men? Only to that point. And when that final moment comes and the work is finished, the final renunciation of the sense of identity terminates the conditioned life of the creature that has integrated in the sphere of mind and now ascends into the Buddhic mystery. What is the state of man in Buddhi? This is something that has been often asked. Because in the Eastern tradition, certainly there is a small stream of souls passing into Buddhi. Very slowly, very few. But through the ages, some have gone on. And such is the account of them that we have in the sacred writings of all people. There are souls that have returned to their own far distant native land. What then is the state of them? I think Buddha gives us some hint of it. I think in the Christian mystery there is also a very definite hint of it. Buddha tells his disciples that he will be with them forever. And Christ tells his disciples, lo, I will be with you always, even unto the end of the world. The Buddhist metaphysics, and the Hindu also, point out that one of the attributes of Buddha is omnipresence. In other words, that which becomes one with the universal light sacrifices a conditioned existence in time and place for an eternal abidance in light. That in some way, the great ones who have gone home live on forever in light, not visible light, but the light of the soul. And they who taught men from the light of their minds and their hearts, so that men gather about them as they gather at the feet of Buddha or Jesus, receive the light of the teacher from without. But after the illumination or the tremendous achievement of the freedom in Buddha, the life and the light of the teacher flows in the world, coming through the world. And as the Mahayanists also point out, the seed of Buddha is planted in every soul that exists in space as part of the omnipotence. And the great illumined ones become the ever-strengthening power of release within the souls of men, strengthening the resolution, the will, and the determination to make the great achievement. So that those who came first to men ultimately come through men, as part of the great life of the soul of the world. Thus we find in Eastern images the innumerable rays of the solar disk, each terminating in one of the meditating forms of the Buddha, the light of the world. And like the mysterious loving hands upon the solar disk of Akhenaten in Egypt, hands forever raising, hands from the universality of things, so that the good mind and the good teacher lives or live on forever in the simple goodness of the light. Thus Buddha and the Hindus also tell us that no man is good. Jesus says the same thing, only the Father is good. Therefore, man does not, in the Buddha, achieve to a state of being good. He achieves real reunion with goodness. He is not good, he is goodness. He returns to the universal fact. He becomes part of the power which he has sought to emulate. He has tried to be good because goodness exists. And he ascends from trying to be good to reunion with the ever-existent goodness itself. Therefore, in the Hindu, man does not become a god, he becomes God. He becomes not another deity in a firmament of gods. He becomes one with the eternal Atma, the being that is, was, and ever shall be. And beyond Buddhi, which is this strange and exalted sheath of over-consciousness, lies the great silence, the Sabbath of the Lord, which is Atma itself. Atma, that which transcends the beautiful and the good, that which finally in its total existence is being itself, going on forever in the pure quality of its own nature. For as Buddhi is light, or the saving power of being, so being itself is life, the moving power behind light and existence. Life forever. Life sustaining, maintaining, unfolding all things, but remaining itself forever the hidden and recondite root of existence. Of this, even the greatest sages have had nothing to say, other than that it is, that it ever shall be, and that its firstborn is light, and that by this light all men who come into the world receive the right of emancipation, the right to go home to the light, to be one with it, by first practicing its ways and finally achieving identity with its substance. If then we can understand the light of Buddhi in a little different term than our familiar way of light, we can also say that as a man entering a dark room turns on the light and suddenly sees every part of that room, so man of mind, living in the darkness of his own intellectual limitation, receiving into himself the light of Buddha, suddenly becomes aware in all parts of his nature and being of the total mystery, the total meaning, the total purpose of existence. Until then he hopes, believes, and fears. He sees as through a glass darkly, but then face to face. And in this mysterious and wonderful experience, which is prefigured and foretold by the visions and dreams of the saints and mystics, and by the subtle experiences within man himself, something of the coming destiny is foretold to him. Something becomes mystically knowable by him. And in this way, he is lured on as the moth to the flame. He goes on to the light because in his own nature it is his destiny. He cannot escape it. But in his final act of acceptance, he must make the voluntary sacrifice of that which is not light. And this is the hardest thing we have to do everywhere in the world. Love is not merely affection. It is the voluntary relinquishment of hate. Truth is not only knowledge, it is the total relinquishment of error. And that which remains always, when that which is not so is removed, is that which is eternally true. So man is forever moving veils from his face, and he is learning to recognize that the error is in him, and that the only place it was born was in him,
The only place that it can die is in him. And that if he would achieve the great light, he must follow the instructions of the Gita, where he must take the sword of quick detachment and cut low the snaky branches of the tree of mind. This is the mystical discipline. Now, there are some who feel, quite rightly, at this stage of things, that if they should give up this selfness, this individuality, that they would give up everything they have. And that would be true at this stage. And it is part of the mystery of Buddhi that every step of its achievement is voluntary. The individual is never for one moment required to make a formal decision in which he is torn between truth and error. Such formal decisions rise in the emotions or in the mind only. And wherever they exist, they bear witness to the failure of the achievement, the conquest of the skanda or limiting instrument. Therefore, before man is able to reach the possibility of Buddhi, he has already ceased to desire anything else. And while his desire for selfhood remains, he is perfectly safe, and just as unsafe as selfhood forces him to be. As long as he believes firmly that he can conquer the universe with his own will, that he can become the total autocrat of his destiny, that ultimately even the gods will bow before him, he is perfectly privileged to go on that way, and he will have all the vicissitudes, mostly bad, which are associated with this concept, which is little better than a complex. But as Buddha pointed out, selfhood is a disease almost incurable. It is the sovereign malady of ignorance. And as man wishes to be sick, he will be sick. And as long as he can endure the sickness, he will have it. And he is not ready for anything better until he realizes fully and completely the inadequacy of what he is. Until then, it is up to him to live his life, fight his way, pay his debts. And he will do so. But there will come a time when man's desire to be himself is exhausted. And at that time, his desire to go home, his desire to return to the eternal life of which he is part, will be stronger than his resolution to continue as a crippled creature in a darkened sphere. When this desire becomes sufficiently strong, he will go home. But no one will force him. Nothing in nature will require it. Nature will have its quiet, simple, prodding way. It will never say anything to him, but it will never give him peace until he achieves the end. That is the very quiet way in which the universe moves all things to its own appointed ends. And the appointed end of man is that he shall have a universal consciousness. And rather than to limit himself by self-mindedness, that he shall again know his kinship with God and know that, like the Savior's also, he is a son of the Eternal, that he too must come into his inheritance, and that this inheritance is God-knowing and God-vision. And to achieve this, he grows and prepares himself, and in the end, he creates the bridge that leads him to the Buddhic plane, where he is at last upon the steps of his father's house, where he is beginning to know and contemplate the effulgent source of light and the magnificent blossoms that hang pendant from the eternal heaven. This Neoplatonism also beautifully brought out, for in its great theurgic disciplines, it taught that man returns to a universal state which he cannot describe, but which is accompanied by the perfect light of his soul, that he becomes inwardly and outwardly luminous, that in all things he participates in the all-knowing of God. Beyond this, definition cannot go. But this is the bridge which must be formed, and this is the end of the chain of vehicles, that man shall transcend bodies and enter into the body of God, which becomes his proper and inevitable vestment. And this is the body which, as Pythagoras of Crotona said, deity is an immense and eternal being, whose body is composed of the substance of light, and whose soul is composed of the substance of truth. And man, experiencing upwardly, comes finally to this transcendent being, changing his own body for the body of God. Actually, of course, all bodies are bodies provided by the mysterious workings of the universal and divine forces. But the Buddhic body is the body of God consciously inhabited, and is the magnificent wedding garment which the soul shall wear at the feast of the bridegroom. This mystery, then, gives us perhaps some concept of Buddha, as best we can do it. We hope that it will help you, and we hope that it will round out and complete our study of the bodies of man.